This week's podcast is sponsored by Endors Interactive's Atlantica. Battle alongside hundreds of your friends in Troy, the upcoming expansion to the award-winning, free-to-play MMORPG Atlantica Online. In the next evolution of Atlantica's turn-based combat system, fight through enormous battlefields and command epic heroes from history, such as Odysseus and Leonidas. Take advantage of the terrain and set traps to dominate your opponents through tactical combat. Learn more at www.playatlantica.com.
Disclaimer! The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show!
From Los Angeles, I'm Justin Svakis.
And I'm Zach Birchie. Welcome to AnCast. And we should mention this is June 11th, and it's Justin's 30th birthday. Happy birthday, dude.
Now, thank you. I wish I could say this has been a great week, but this has been a really fucking rough week.
Yes, it has. for both of us in many different ways. And to that effect, I've been incredibly distracted this week by other things and didn't really get around to watching any anime. I did see, over the weekend, I saw Get Him to the Greek, which I loved, and probably the best movie I've seen so far this year. I really like
I'm not surprised. It's, from the Apatow.
It's from the Apatow crowd. I have an unhealthy man crush on Russell Brand.
And what? Really? I find him utterly repellent.
It seems like it goes one way or the other. Either you love the guy or you hate the guy. I love the guy. It was just really funny, and it was a very good time at the movies. Have you seen anything lately?
No, there's been nothing in theaters. I've just been that I wanted to see, at least.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you forget about Sex in the City, too.
Right. The skate wall.
Oh, yeah, seriously. So I've just kind of been going through the library, just trolling through the massive pile of stuff I've just never watched before. Mm-hmm. Discovered a couple interesting things, a lot of really terrible ones. The one thing that I dug out of nowhere was Genesis Survivor Gaiarth.
What the?
Do you remember that?
In the very back of my head, part of me remembers that, yeah.
Yeah, anime, it was this three-part, you know, kind of post-apocalyptic-y fantasy show. Really, well, maybe not post-apocalyptic, but very, very, very generic. Animego released it on VHS. They never got the DVD rights. This is one of those shows that just kind of was appreciated back when it came out, but if you release this today, it would sell 4 units.
What is it about?
Always
a good response.
Yeah. I mean, I knew, but you know how, like, the minute you watch something, you immediately forget it?
Yeah.
Like, it's like you finish something, writing something on your computer, and you're just like, well, that's over, and then you just throw the file immediately in the trash.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the effect of watching this show. It was, I didn't even remember watching it when I was, you know, in the VHS era, but I sure don't remember watching it last week.
Great. Well, aren't we a couple of valuable commentators?
utterly hopeless. But I have also been catching up on Durarara, and now that it's being streamed, Rainbow.
Oh, yeah, I need to get to that. Although, like, half the people I know have dropped it. Like, they're not watching it anymore.
Rainbow or Durarara?
Rainbow.
I still like Rainbow, actually. It's basically a really cheesy potboiler soap opera for 60-year-old men who remember when Japan was full of, you know, guts and bile.
Right.
It's so over the top that you're kind of embarrassed that you were enjoying it this much.
Interesting. Well, I'll look, during a week when I am less hyper distracted, I'm sure I will get to it. Sounds pretty interesting. So there's a lot of news this week.
A whole lot of news.
We should start with the manga thing. So basically a whole bunch of Japanese publishers and a couple of American publishers have gotten together and they're going to start cracking down on the for-profit scanlation sites.
To which I say, thank God.
Yeah, this is good. This is a good thing. And I got to tell you, the forum's response to any anti-piracy effort on behalf of the industry is really fucking irritating. There is no one perfect solution, and I'm really sick of anytime they try anything, it's like, well, this isn't going to work. Well, piracy is still going to happen. Well, scanlation is still going to... Yes, okay, we know that. But they have to try something, you know?
The goal isn't to shut off piracy. The goal is to make piracy just hard enough that people might be less lazy and might actually buy something.
Yeah, I mean, not only that, these sites are fucking despicable. Like, they're making... Like Chris mentioned in the forums, that one manga... or whatever it is, that site makes like he's planning on selling it for like 8 figures.
My one manga actually has more traffic than us ever, than Crunchyroll ever combined.
Yeah.
It is one of the top 1,000 websites in the world. Now, what do you, and all of it, 100% of that is outright theft for profit.
Yeah, and half of it is like scans of like Viz books and shit, right?
Yeah, I mean these aren't even scanlations that were, innocently uploaded. This is outright piracy, and the only reason that people think it's cool is because no one has to pay to use it.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like complaining that Hollywood studios shut down the Chinese bootleg DVD vendors in Chinatown. You know, why are you complaining about that? There is a law. There is, you know, these. It's fucking frustrating. So I'm really
Basically, here is what it is. People are used to getting something for free. They won't be able to get it for free anymore. They're scared about losing something and having to pay money for something that they were previously getting for free. That's pretty much the short and the end of it.
Yeah, all the arguments are transparent. It's not really about that. It's about, wow, you're taking away my free shit. That's it.
Right.
There's no like, well, if you think about it this way, like that's all that is bullshit justification. Like I hope they shut down those sites. Those are really a cancer. Like we were really, or I was very aggressive towards Crunchyroll back when they were, profiting off of streaming fan subs. Like
same here.
You know,
it took me a long time to warm up to them.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the reason I said I is because I ran that interview where I basically
right
jumped all over that guy.
can't really say that didn't happen there.
yeah.
We'll hard brush that under the bridge when it's in our archives.
Yeah, exactly.
The one manga is arguably more powerful on the internet than any other publisher, and you know when that is your property, you have to defend yourself. Otherwise, your copyright is worthless, and there is just no point to producing anything.
Yeah, yeah, it's a demotivator. It's horrible. So I hope those guys fucking burn in hell.
I have no love lost here. I mean, if the one we just got a new news post that a competing site, Manga Helpers, just shut down.
Oh yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so that, and they're trying to, retool themselves as something that might actually help, an open aggregator that allows indie publishers to upload and bill and everything, and that would be really cool.
Yeah.
I wish more of these companies would make moves like that.
Yeah, I mean, Crunchyroll went legit, and now they're great, now it's a great place. Like,
yeah.
I love going there, they have a good service. Although, we've got our own shit going on.
Yeah.
You should talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, if anyone ever wondered what I actually did all day, it's this. So, over the last 6 months or so, we've been, really pushing the video behind the scenes, but the player itself was utterly broken. And everyone who used our player could probably tell you that. Mm-hmm. You were having troubles just watching the stuff.
I wouldn't use it.
Yeah, big, giant glitch every time a commercial came up. It was just not a workable solution. The reason we did that was because none of us know Flash. Flash is really hard, at least the sort of Flash that, requires a scripting and everything and deep programming. So we used this open source player that didn't really work. So finally, we got the lead out and made our own, and it's much better now. At the same time, we built up a whole lot of backlog from Funimation. We built up a whole lot of backlog from other licensors. We did closed a bunch of other deals. We have more that I'm about to close. We built up 1,000 episodes of just stuff I've never posted.
Interesting.
That we have the rights to. And so that's going to be my summer. We're just going to post like a new show every couple of days. We also got our first official title. And I know I was supposed to announce this last week, but we had some last minute bugs with the player. But Nobody's Boy Remy, which is a show that's very near and dear to my heart, we got streaming rights for. And we're going to be posting that up starting on Sunday.
It's going to be a depressing summer.
Oh, yes. Hey, you know, misery loves company, right?
Right.
You know, if you look on the news and the BP oil spills got you down, why don't you tune in and watch a French kid suffer?
That's a good point.
it's a really good show. Very, very heartwarming. But this show, I'm really proud of it because it almost broke Chris Beveridge.
Oh, really?
Like, he loves this show. Like, he called it the big surprise of, I forget when I put that DVD out, like 2008, was it?
Well, if it was Chris, he would have said, one of the more depressing shows this season.
No, this was his Right Stuff interview. But yeah, basically he got to like the fourth or fifth volume and he's like, I'm not sure how much more of this I could take. This is just heartbreaking.
Wow.
And, you know, at the office when we were working at an Imagination, my intern was like, this is a drinking game. Take a shot every time Remy is utterly disillusioned with life.
Yeah, well, it's nice that it's accessible because Lord knows you can't really get those DVDs anymore. So, yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of this stuff. I mean, we're doing the streaming thing, but obviously we don't have the manpower of someone like Crunchyroll. Yeah. We can't do like 20 simultaneous streams, simulcast from Japan. That's just not something we're capable of doing. I'm not even sure I'm capable of one yet. I might give it a try. But so really the best way of going about this for us is to find the stuff that is either forgotten or, you know, maybe was released at one point, but is really good and probably could have reached some more people if it was still available, and trying to get those titles. And that's kind of my focus going forward.
Cool. Well, sounds good. That's exciting. That's definitely definitely exciting. But one thing.
A lot
of work. Yeah, exactly. Totally. I wanted to mention this because I can't believe how fucking retarded it is. I was taking a look at AX's ticketing policy, Anime Expo's ticketing policy, which I kind of can't believe. I really kind of can't believe. At the same time, I shouldn't be surprised by this.
If there was any doubt about what all of the people that quit were saying about the new management, this should completely obliterate that doubt. These people are morons.
So here's what's happening. If you go to Anime Expo, let's say you show up to Anime Expo on Thursday, July 1st, and you decide, I'm going to buy a 4-day pass, and hey, I sure would like to see the Masquerade, and oh, I'm interested in this concert. You get to pay $85 for a 4-day pass, then you get to pay $20 for each concert you want to see, then you get to pay another $20 for the Masquerade.
Jesus! This is suddenly a $300 event!
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous. I can't believe they're charging for the main events. Initially when I read the site, it looked like they were charging for opening and closing ceremonies and the anime music video contest.
Which would have been entirely illegal.
Which would have been so illegal. But there's a little thing at the bottom of the ticketing page that says, oh, these are $0 tickets. You still have to get tickets for them, but they're $0. And the policy is like, if you want to get into those events, you have to pay give them the $20 per event. And if there's tickets left, ooh, I wonder if there'll be tickets left, they'll give them away for free right before the show starts. So what this means is they're going to be giving away 500 tickets.
Oh my God.
Because fucking no one is going to, there are going to be a few diehards that'll pay the $20 for the Masquerade.
If I was in Masquerade, and I would never be in Masquerade, I'm not that sort of showman, but if I was one of the kids that participates in Masquerade, I would be pretty pissed that I was not getting a cut of the door.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, are they getting a cut? No. Like, of course they're not. It's just, it's so stupid. This is such, like, dumb, like, corporate America-style greed. Like, it's so stupid. And it's so clear that they don't know what they're doing. Like the guy that they brought,
yeah, this is supposed to be a community event, basically.
Yeah, it's supposed to be for fans, and like the guy they brought in fucking runs like malls. So of course this is how he thinks. Like, well, oh, it's popular. Why don't we charge people extra for that? Because it's fucking goodwill. Like, you're gonna piss off all of your attendees if you charge them to get into the most popular event at the convention.
That the one is, that everyone actually, you know, pays your entry fee for.
Yeah, exactly. Stupid. Like, I'm really hoping that they cancel this policy, or they decide at the event that all tickets are for the main events are free, or whatever. It's just, it's so stupid, and it's, you're just taking advantage.
I understand why they're doing it, though.
Yeah. Oh, yes, greed. That's the reason.
No, it's not. Well, partially, yes. But the thing is, they are broke. Their entire volunteer staff quit. They had to hire IDG World Expo to replace them. That costs money. This is a nonprofit. They don't have that kind of money.
Yes, it's supposed to be run like a nonprofit, and the guy they brought in doesn't know how to operate like a nonprofit. This is entirely their fault. I have no sympathy for them.
I'm not defending them. Yeah. I'm saying, you know, this is, at some point, they have to get money somewhere, or this show is going to be over.
Yeah, I mean,
they are not going to have an AX if they keep this up.
Yeah, that guy needs to figure out how to spend like a nonprofit. Like, you know, it's upsetting to me personally because, you know, I've been going to that convention for 10 years.
So have I.
It's near and dear to my heart. As much as I hate to admit it, it's part of my life. And, like, I hate to see it turned into this just shitty, like, greedy corporate America-style thing. It's just ugly.
Well, you know, it would be one thing if they were making anyone happy. Like, if they were the people in the dealer room, if they were happy, if anybody was happy with what was going on. Nobody's happy. Everyone's mutinous.
Yeah.
The only people that seem to be excited about AX this year are the Japanese companies that are completely unaware of what's happening.
It's a real shame.
Everyone who's listening to this from an anime company, call your Japanese overlords. Let them know.
Yeah. And then here's the thing. Like, I'm still rooting for them. I still hope that they pull it out. I hope there's an Anime Expo next year. I hope that, you know, they manage to pull this off. I am still rooting for them. I can't help that. I don't want them to fail. I certainly don't want, you know, the biggest anime convention, solo anime convention in the country to fail. I really don't want that to happen.
No, we do not need that.
Yeah, we don't need that right now. We need that thing to succeed.
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, AX has always been known for being at least a little dysfunctional.
Yeah.
But this is a level of asshattery that I'm not used to seeing.
Here's the thing. It was previously sort of charmingly dysfunctional. It's like, oh, they're fans. Like, you know.
Right. Fan drama.
Yeah, fans. Yeah, but this is like, it's just like depressing, shitty corporate America stuff.
This makes me long for the days when AX's board meeting ended in screaming in tears.
Yeah. And you'd get some press release from Chase that's full of typos. It was all and those seem like innocent days now compared to this.
It's so scrappy, and you know, they were trying. They were all trying so hard. That's what gave it its charm, is that everyone cared.
Yeah, everyone really
cared about the fan experience. Everyone cared about putting on a cool show. This is so, the motivation has shifted so entirely that it's kind of offensive to me what the end goal is now.
Yeah, well, and it's especially sad because it's the SPJA, you know, and they,
Society for the Promotion, you know, of Japanese Animation.
Yeah, and it's been corrupted, I think. Is what we're talking about here.
What is the end game here? I don't even know. I mean,
based on what I've heard, and we are going to be interviewing these folks, so hopefully I can get some answers. But the end game I've heard is that now it's about profit. Now it's about profit, and that's what their new goal is. Thanks to the new management, it's all about making money. You know, they shit can Chase because there wasn't monumental growth year over year, you know? It was kind of flat for 1 year, and so they shit-canned him, you know?
Was that the rationale?
That they gave, yeah.
I'm willing to bet there has to be more to it than that.
Oh, I know there's more. I personally know there's more to it than that. But the rationale they gave was like, well, we only saw, you know, our growth was flat from 2008 to 2009.
I'm not going to put stock in that lip service.
Yeah. But even that is a bullshit reason. Like, that is a bullshit reason. We're not seeing monumental growth in money and profits. Let's fucking change everything.
You know, the worst part of this is I'm not going to be able to get to go to Otakon this year.
Yeah, no, I can't go either.
So this is going to be my only con this year.
Oh, man. Will you not go to New York?
Oh, right. Well, I don't really consider that part of the con season because it's so late in the year.
Yeah, it's in September. But
October, because it's combined with Comic-Con.
Oh, right. Yeah. So Otakon is kind of the last remaining big, truly fan-run convention. And hey, we're having those guys on pretty soon.
Excellent.
So before we get to the guest, we should mention that
We taped this yesterday.
Yeah, we taped this yesterday, or 2 days ago.
2 days ago, yeah.
And the guy, this guy had a role in bringing Battle Angel to Fox, the live-action version of Battle Angel to Fox. He pitched it to them. Unfortunately, there's apparently a whole bunch of Hollywood bullshit going on with that, so he wasn't able to talk about it. So that's why.
And by bullshit, we don't mean something that would necessarily hold up production, just drama.
Yeah, it's drama. So he wasn't able to talk about it, so that's why it's not in the interview. If it's conspicuously missing, that's why. So let's go ahead and get to that. Hey, folks, just wanted to remind you this week's podcast is sponsored by the good folks at Endors Interactive and their MMORPG, Atlantica Online. You can check that out at www.playatlantica.com. And now back to your regularly scheduled terrible commercial from the 90s.
Hey, watch me get Fred's Fruity Pebbles.
Who are you?
I'm the master rapper and I'm here to sing. I love Fruity Pebbles in a major way.
He loves Fruity Pebbles in a major way.
The bedrock, yellow, orange, purple, lime, and red. But to get the fruity taste, I gotta trick Fred. Fruity.
To get the fruity taste, he's gotta trick Fred. Barney.
Guess that's a wrap.
How's Fruity Pebbles cereal? Part of this nutritious breakfast.
Okay, our guest this week is screenwriter and professor of manga and anime screenwriting at University of California, Irvine.
Formerly of Irvine. Yeah, I was teaching at Irvine before, yeah.
Okay, well, Northrop Davis, thanks so much for thanks so much for being on the show, dude. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really honored to be here, and I appreciate you asking me.
Yeah, so tell people a little bit about yourself, exactly what you do. I think you're sort of a nebulous personality when it comes to anime fans, but you're a pretty important guy. So tell us about what you do.
Well, I don't know how important I am, but I'm pretty much one of the rare people, you know, the few people that is in the intersection between the Japanese entertainment world, and particularly manga and anime, and Hollywood. And there are plenty of people who have expertise in both areas, but not many that are in the middle there. And I was originally a screenwriter, and I sold a script, for instance, to Warner Brothers and the Donners as producers, and sold pitches to two other studios. And I wrote as development deals. And then I ended up getting very into manga and anime. Actually was dating someone in Japan and really fell in love with the form, and then got to the point where I brought up a project over here and pitched it, and kind of was one of the very first people in this. I think several years before Tim Burton had been involved in a project that he's still involved in, but I was a very, very early adopter, both for the people in Japan who I was new to, you know, being a Westerner at that point and approaching them about rights, as well as the people in Hollywood who'd really mostly never seen anything like it. And of course, now it's become a lot more high profile.
So what era are we talking about here? Like what year?
Well, it was the late 1990s when I discovered, you know, not discovered, but I came across Battle Angel Lita. So it was that point that I had gotten involved with that, and so that would be when it began for me. And so at that point, there had been earlier, of course, you know, if you go back in manga anime history, there was earlier incarnations, like in the 60s with Astro Boy being brought over by Fred Ladd to NBC and Kimba the White Lion, and then, you know, later the incarnations, of course, anime coming over with Dragon Ball and Pokemon and all that, you know, in the 1980s. And then But I think for live action adaptation of manga and anime, there I was very, very early in. I believe Tim Burton was in a few years earlier on a project that was anime manga, but there's probably scattered others, you know, that, but it was pretty, I was pretty new to the Japanese when they met me. That I was very, very, something they hadn't seen, I think. And
I don't suppose you could tell us what this Tim Burton project is, could you?
I think it's, I'm actually not familiar with the project, but I think, is it Maya the Psychic Girl?
Oh, Maya the Psychic Girl. Yeah. I think I heard about that, but anyway.
Yeah. And I think I read recently that he was revisiting it potentially. But I learned that from, one of my contacts in Japan that way early on he had been in looking into that or perhaps optioned it. I'm not sure.
Now, Hollywood has been mining the manga section of comic stores for well over a decade now, going through and trying to find something worth adapting. And you know, with the sole exception of a couple of really, really huge properties, Battle Angel being one of them, and the ones that we know got made and subsequently tanked, it seems like very few have really gotten off the ground. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think generally in Hollywood, the statistical likelihood of any particular project getting made is very slim. I mean, not incredibly slim, but I think the odds are really against you, of course. But I can't speak for the people at the studios who are, you know, in charge of greenlighting or not greenlighting these, but I would imagine that the same factors come into play in those that come into play in anything. Having to do with scheduling of talent, you know, comfort with the actual screenplay that's been developed, and a whole lot of mixing of luck and scheduling and other things, that many of which may be fairly unfortunately unrelated to what we would like to think as the purest possible, you know, creative decisions. But that probably wouldn't be limited to any kind of business art combination that has these kind of budgets involved and this kind of risk involved. I sound like a lawyer, I know, but
hey, that's the reality of it. So, you know, one thing that really shocked me, I'm a pretty new Hollywood transplant. I just got out here like a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that shocked the hell out of me getting out here is just meeting people, talking to people. No one is immediately derisive of you for being into anime here. It's really bizarre, but it seems like no one actually knows anything about it.
Yeah. When I started presenting it, I was kind of viewed as if kind of like a performing seal or something. And it was kind of like, look at the writer, isn't he funny? I, you know, and just like I was juggling fire in front of them or something. And it was this big entertainment thing, kind of like almost like, but they were intrigued because of my passion, because anybody who comes in passionate, it kind of catches people's eyes, you know, and because he seems so committed to it, maybe there's something to it. And I don't know why there isn't more kind of like really, really getting into it, but perhaps I can't really speculate. I'm not sure why. I know what you're talking about. There's like a lack of like, they don't have an otaku knowledge of it.
Well, it even goes beyond that. It's like they're intrigued by the idea of anime, but they've never taken the chance to actually look into it. Like, no one knows anything beyond Ghost in the Shell.
I'm hoping that some of the younger, newer people are not new. You know, some people who are working in these organizations are, you know, going home and reading it out of the love of it and getting really into the world. And let's just hope more and more of them do that. And I would think that the more that they do that, the more positive that's going to be. I know what you're talking about. I think what you're saying is a love and passion for it versus a, we could potentially make money out of this.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm not entirely sure what I'm talking about either.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's probably got the same level of, it's got more of a level of penetration in the movie industry than it does out in the society in general in America, perhaps. Hard to say.
Now, do you think that, so that's all well and good, but the two projects that have actually gotten out the door, Speed mm-hmm. Racer and Dragon Ball Evolution, at this point are sort of famous flops. Now, I mean, speaking as an inside baseball guy, has that damaged the ability of the, and Astro Boy actually, also a flop, So that's three. Has that damaged the potential for anime properties to get picked up, or do people just sort of ignore that and say, well, this one's different or whatever?
I think that initially there was the fear among those few of us who are involved in this to that degree that would hurt things. But I think quickly it became apparent that, no, that hadn't really stopped anything in terms of interest. But I think, for instance, for Speed Racer, I took my daughter to it, and she liked it. She was, you know, like 11 years old. But I said, well, why isn't this a hit? And she said, it wasn't marketed right. And I said, what? And she said,
you have an amazing 11-year-old.
She's amazing. She's the most mature person in our family. But she said, well, because it was really aimed to be a kid's kiddie movie, and they were aiming it for like the 7-year-olds. And so all of us 11-year-olds felt that's baby stuff. So she felt it was the marketing that was the problem with it. But I can't. To that, that's what she thought. I'm blaming everything on my daughter, but regarding the Dragon Ball, that's a whole debate about that, of course. But I think the feeling generally about these projects is that it can have made $1 billion in the worldwide markets ahead of time, but that if the story itself and the final screenplay doesn't reflect something that has the special thing that the Japanese work had, but at the same time is accessible to the rest of the world, particularly beginning in America, then it doesn't matter how much it made or didn't make. So that's rather interesting. It's almost like you're coming in there saying this sold $1 billion, and they're going, well, that's nice, you know, but really those fans aren't going to probably go to this. Right. And you know what I'm saying? So that's got to really work. On its own terms as a Hollywood movie.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you teach, so that's sort of speaking to the problems with the script, basically. And you are specifically, like, your whole world is adapting manga and anime into screenplays. So what's your philosophy of adaptation when you sit down to adapt a property? What are the big things for you? What are the big hurdles for you?
Well, actually, because if I'm serving as a, you know, trying to produce a property, you know, and I've not yet gotten one produced, but if I'm trying to produce it, then there's that initial, why did I go to that? And why did we try to secure it? And so that it's got to have certain qualities that I think are accessible to Westerners. But it's like the plot structure, for instance, and I'm not trying to pretend that I'm an adapter of these because I haven't been hired to do that. But as looking at it from which one to choose, the plot structure is important because mangas tend to wander off the spine of the plot, way off it. And it works really, really well for the form. But when you're trying to adapt that into the Western screenplay form where you've only got 120 minutes or 90 minutes, it can become very problematic. So certain rare mangas have this tighter structure, and that can be very attractive for adaptation. But there's a whole host of other things I'm looking for, you know, like what kind of world is it establishing, and particularly the characters, because they're so great with their great characters. And you want to preserve the three-dimensionality of the characters and the kind of Japanese history of showing the dark side of each character, including the ones who are apparently the good person, the good guy. You know, they don't have that black hat, white hat thing, you good guy, bad guy, et cetera, that we have done so much. And I think that's infected our own storytelling now here on television and in graphic novels. The Japanese have had maybe an influence on it and giving us a lot more palette to work with. And so you want to keep that attractiveness, but at the same time, you want to make sure that the plot's going to work. And there are certain ones that had a very tight plot to begin with and then wander all over the place. Berserk being a good example. You know, right. It's really tight until the eclipse. And then after that, it's just all over the place.
Right.
Yeah. Plus, Americans only like a certain amount of monster rape in their entertainment.
Yeah, there are those elements to it.
Are there certain genres, obviously monster rape not being one of them, that's an easier pitch than other genres?
Well, I think shoujo has not yet come of age here in terms of Hollywood really looking at it. I mean, I think they're beginning to look at it. I always thought that would be the second wave after shonen. But although things like Berserk, Mira would say that Berserk has a lot of shoujo elements, which it does. It's tough to know what to be able to nail it down that way, you know. But I think these world building mangas like Ghost in the Shell and like Battle Angel Alita do have a lot of kind of going for them on top of everything else that they've got going for them, in that they have that very well developed visual world that Hollywood does specialize in certain genres like science fiction, and because they have the budgets and the expertise to produce things on that level. So that, I think those have some advantage, but there's not that many of those properties, are there?
Well, there's less than there seemed to be in the 80s, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So are you still continuing to pitch projects, new projects?
Yes, yes, yes.
Now, it seems like, you know, from the point of view of the people that live and breathe this stuff, anime, we're nowhere near as prominent as we were like 5 years ago. Like the bubble as far as the home video space is gone. You don't see us in Suncoast anymore because there are no Suncoasts. And it's just, it seems like we've fallen off the radar. How has that affected how you pitch, and do you still get as much like, oh, anime, now I'm interested, or do you still get that?
Well, that's interesting, because initially it was kind of like, what are you talking about? You know, tell me about it. And now it's like they know what it is, but I think that there's a very high level of, yes, but prove it to me. Prove that this is going to work for what we do. And they're very smart about that. I don't think anybody's just going, whoa, you just bought me in an anime that you have the rights secured on. Just sure, here's a, you know, let's do the deal. So I think you really, really have to prove it to them very, very much that it's going to work as a story. Unless you have that kind of executive who just really believes in you and they just believe in your vision, and then it may be a little bit easier to do it. But they may very well look at something that, say, you've created as a screenplay and you bring in a $1 billion anime and they go, nope, doesn't work for us. What do you have? And you'll go, wait a minute, what did I just show you? And the point they're trying to make is that a incredibly valuable work could have sold no copies at all, but it could be very, very perfect for adaptation, or very few copies. Isn't that interesting? So I find that they're not bowled over by the big sales numbers like you would think that they would, at least the people I deal with. They're a lot more they're a lot smarter than that and a lot more careful, because they realize that those fans that necessarily like that bought into that series won't necessarily buy into their movie, that they have to sell their movie to a different fan base, actually.
Right. So then that becomes incredibly tricky to figure that out.
Yes, incredibly tricky. For instance, right, exactly. Because really, ultimately, I think in the perfect world, what many people would like was a finished, perfect, great screenplay delivered with a manga or anime that has already made $1 billion.
Right.
But since that doesn't exist, you have to look at this differently from like a Harry Potter or like an American superhero comic, where they feel like they're starting from scratch as far as the fan base goes.
Correct. I think the general consensus, at least to when I'm in, is that they feel they're starting from scratch with the fan base. I can't speak for them because I'm not on that side of the desk, but they're going to expect only to get a few people domestically who are fans of the series to go to the movie, and that's not enough to support a big release by far. So they want to know that it'll work in this form.
Given anime sales numbers, that sounds like a pretty smart thing to think.
Well, I think the key, though, is that that you don't, in trying to appeal to that understandable feeling, that you don't then take out what's special about the work. Because then what you've done is you've ruined the original work and made it into something that it's not.
Really. Dragon Ball.
It's just a balancing act. I mean, the project that's really close to my heart, one of them right now that we have the rights and are bringing to Hollywood, is Barefoot Gen. Are y'all familiar with that?
Yeah.
Right. How do you pitch that to Hollywood? It's so clearly a Japanese story.
Right. It's really we do it out of love, and like love, it's going to involve a lot of heartbreak. But I think whenever you do things for the right reasons, it might create some really good karma. And naturally, it seems like a very, very tall order to pitch something that has an all-Japanese cast for Hollywood to produce that involves the atomic bombing. But when I first read this piece, I just thought, this is such a fantastic anti-war piece, because it really it's a really universal story, not only of great hope, but as well, of course, an indictment against nuclear weapons, which is so important, at least to myself and my Japanese partner in this. But also, it's a really amazing story about what happened before the bomb dropped, which is, again, the main character's family was really a pretty amazing bunch of rebels in Hiroshima pre-bomb. I mean, his father spoke out against the war. He didn't think Japanese could win it with their lack of natural resources. And he was actually active in the theater locally. And they were really, really treated terribly by neighbors and community people for their stance. And they were attacked physically. The father was taken to the police station and beaten up. And the daughter was sexually harassed in the story yet, you know, and part of it is fiction that Nakazawa created, but he really was in the atomic bomb blast. He was within a kilometer of it. Wow. He was walking to school and he bent over to pick something up off the ground. And that's when the bomb went off and it just saved him, this wall in front of him. And he just had this horrific thing happen to him, with most of his family dying and his mother surviving and her being pregnant, having the baby and taking care of her. And in the amazing hell this was, but it's an amazing, it's just such a wonderful story. And we really want to try to get it made, but it's such a work of passion, and he's alive, and we're trying. We would like it, you know, for Spielberg to get it to him. We're trying to get it to Spielberg because Nakazawa wants Spielberg to direct it.
Yeah. I've written a little bit about the anime film from the early 80s, and mm-hmm. that is one of the hardest anime I've ever seen to watch. That the nuclear bomb scene is just it burns at you. It burns away at your consciousness for like days afterwards.
Yeah, it's amazing, that sequence from the dropping of the bomb and the dog biting down in pain on that bridge railing and then just melting, and the baby and the mother and the whole thing is just, you do feel like you're there, and the way that it's represented in a way is more real than real, because it's animated.
Well, that sounds like a four-quadrant picture.
Well, of course it's not, but in a way we think it is. You know, I was talking to a Japanese friend, and they were saying it is four-quadrant. I said, well, that's an interesting statement. And they felt that the horror of it really is something that would actually attract some people in the wrong way to see it. But then once they were in there, they would become swept up in the story. And because Spielberg and Hanks and
your Japanese friend has clearly never met a normal American film goer. Well, that is not how we operate.
Well, we're thinking for HBO that it would be fantastic, given that they made The Pacific. Mm. And also we thought that, you know, given Clint Eastwood, what he did with Letters from Iwo Jima, that there still is a chance of it to be made as a theatrical feature as well. And we think HBO in particular. And it was made into a very hit two-part Japanese television movie by their top network, Fuji TV, a couple years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, and it was the top rated two-part movie that summer. It's required reading in many schools in Korea, and it's sold millions and millions of copies worldwide. So
that's interesting that you bring up the notion of an HBO miniseries. Mm-hmm. Or would you envision it as an HBO movie or a miniseries?
I'm not sure if it would be a movie or a miniseries. The great thing is that the series continued on for 10 volumes, all of which are published in the United States now. I went one time to the bookstore, I think it's Meltdown Comics, mm-hmm. and they said that it was one of their biggest sellers, the clerk there, or the person working there, which amazed me. And the Nakazawa series continues on with the American occupation, where the young Japanese kids think that the Americans are going to eat their guts out, you know, cannibalize them, because that's what they've been told. And then the GIs give them gum, and they can't believe it. And then the gum's so sweet, they can't believe it, because they're not used to sweet food. And there's all these things that happened during black market era, you know, post-war Japan that go on and on. And actually, Nakazawa was going to continue the series with his character becoming a mangaka, because he became a mangaka in other areas. I think science fiction and sports. And then it was not until the death of his mother and that he decided, I believe at that point, to do a series about the atomic bomb experience, because the atomic bomb survivors, I don't know if you are aware, but many of the listeners probably are, were actually shunned. I mean, they were really encouraged not to talk about the experience in society, so they kept it inward. And the manga was really a moment at which this could be released. And it is not at all a piece that's about the bad Americans. It's really a condemnation of the people who he felt started the war. The anime later, I think, is more two-dimensional in its approach. But I think the manga, when he wrote it fresh, really had all the passion of a young man writing about this and telling the truth.
Right. Isn't there a Barefoot Gentoo anime, Justin?
I haven't watched the whole thing because it's so anticlimactic after the first one.
Right.
It's more about the, you know, reconstruction, and the art style's different, and the first one is the anime that needs to be seen. And in fact, it's so weak. When Pioneer released the DVDs, they just put them both on one disc.
Yeah, I would really encourage all the listeners, if they can, to go back to the original manga, particularly volumes 1 and 2. Because reading the first one, the bomb doesn't drop till the end of it, the first volume. And that really sets it up so wonderfully, this family, because the family is just amazing. His father, his mother, they were incredible. And later on, there's great scenes in the manga that are not in the anime, for instance, of his brother going and meeting kamikaze pilots, and then sequences with kamikaze pilots going off and flying over their fiance and mother in the field and trying to ditch their plane because they don't want to die, and the experiences of Gin's brother rebelling against his father's past anti-war stance and joining the military, and then his horrible experiences in the military.
Right. Very interesting. So before we get to your listener questions here, mm-hmm. Are there any properties out there right now, besides obviously the ones we've already been talking about, are there any properties out there that you've taken a look at and said, this should be an American film or a TV series? Anything that really stuck out to you?
Well, I mean, that's a tough question. It's a very good question. But the thing is, if there is a property like that, then we've already secured it, or we're trying to secure it. And if we're trying to secure it, we don't really want anybody else to know about it.
Right.
Because then they can try to secure it while we're trying to secure it. So to keep my partner from, you know, making me perform a ritual suicide, I probably should not answer that one.
Okay, well, conversely, anything that's already been snapped up by someone else that you wish you were involved in?
Well, I think Death Note seemed like it had tremendous potential if done the right way, and certainly Warner Brothers has that one. And there's great people working on that, like Dan Lin. And
that screenplay was pretty, that got leaked, was pretty rough.
Oh, I didn't see that. I didn't see that. Of course, there's other major projects like Ghost in the Shell, and I really haven't tracked any of them or looked at the internal development of them because it's so time-consuming to just be involved in what we're involved in. Mm-hmm. And so I don't really know where they're at, really, any of them. I mean, I think we'll all hear when they're going to be made, if they're going to be made. But certainly there are several others that have been. Akira, of course, was the rights were acquired. And then there are some others. There's a pretty short list. It's not that many that the deals close. And a lot of the reason for that is because of the differences between the approach of the Japanese rights holders and the approach of Hollywood people, and the way that they look at things. I can get into that if you want.
Well, one thing that has been interesting to me is that it seems like most screenwriters, when they tackle an adaptation project, not necessarily in regards to anime, but just in general, there seems to kind of be this unmistakable urge to just want to put their stink on it. You know, that just to really just kind of, well, that story doesn't work in that direction, really kind of really make their mark on it, as opposed to letting the strength of the original idea flow through.
I think that it's very I've heard screenwriters, and as a screenwriter who has, you know, sold a script and sold a couple pitches, and I have heard, you know, even friends who are screenwriters talking about that horrible script that they got called in to maybe get the rewrite on, and I always really wince at that because I wonder, is that ego talking, that they've got to just make it their own way, or is it really an attempt to solve what they see as a problem that is a legitimate problem while trying to preserve the essence of what was good in the first place? Because there was a reason why, I mean, you know, this manga is a success, or this screenplay was purchased. We hope for a good reason that it was good. And so I think that it's important, and hopefully the executive or whoever's involved is going to be very aware of what's going on there and going to hopefully keep that from happening. I've heard executives say that if they hear a screenwriter come in and say bad things about what they're being told, asked to take a shot at rewriting, that they have problems with that because they think that that's all that person could do is criticize. But I think it's important to be careful. You're right, not to come from ego and to really, really just try to make it better.
Well, yeah, I think there's also kind of a balancing act when you find the right artist for the right project. Like, the Wachowskis' stink, as Justin put it so eloquently, is all over Speed Racer, but it works with that material. Like, it does work. That's actually a success. Yeah. I would consider that film a successful adaptation, even though it failed at the box office. The film itself is a successful adaptation. It did everything they struck out to do.
I agree with you. I agree with you.
Yeah, so I guess, yeah, like you said, you really got to find the right guy for the project, and it sounds like a sort of unwavering enthusiasm is the order of the day when it comes to that kind of thing.
I'm not sure. I guess it would depend on the situation, but there's certainly a difference in these negotiations and the tactics and styles of between the different sides of the ocean as well, because over there the publishers are very, very powerful, and they're in a very strong position with the television and filmmakers. And over here, really, Hollywood's in the very strong position versus the publishers. So the negotiations themselves get very complicated because they're two very different systems. And the creative latitude that people are given to adapt these in America obviously are contractually designated by the contract, and what kind of latitude the contract allows. And naturally, the mangaka would like to sometimes control things, you know, to try to make sure, like have script approval or actor approval and things like that. But of course, those become very difficult for a movie company that's going to make a $200 million film to allow this kind of restraints, because you know, for instance, a television show to have script approval while it's in production. It's like, you know, one of our entertainment lawyers described a television show as a car racing down a hill with its emergency brake off with no driver, and the whole crew is chasing it. And trying to catch up with it. So these kind of things create some difficulties in these negotiations. And that just gets back to your question about what is being made. And I think very few of these deals close because there's a lot of difficulties in the negotiation because of very different styles. And nobody's right and nobody's wrong, but they just have different agendas. Because the mangakas are also – the very successful ones are very, very wealthy.
So you're crossing your fingers hoping that you don't suddenly get a note one day that they're demanding Will Smith play Gen.
Right. That's you mean from the Hollywood side?
Yeah, from the Japanese side. You said they want actor approval sometimes.
Well, yes. They will sometimes ask for that. And you know, each negotiation is different. And, you know, so there are all these things. And what we try to do is really bridge the gap between the two and try to find a common ground that both sides are happy with and that they become collaborative partners rather than adversaries. And that's really, really the key thing.
Especially when the manga artist is crazy.
Did you hear me answer? No, I didn't say anything.
Yeah. Okay, Justin, you have any more follow-ups, or shall we
let's get to Twitter.
Okay, we only have a few. I think your people were a little short on, you know, wow, what do I ask this guy? So here's one from Vinny Ev. Do you think movies based off lesser-known anime would do well? Like the idea that, you know, high-quality books, plays, short stories have made some of the greatest movies, and, you know, you don't sell it as an adaptation of something. You just bring it as a story.
I'm a little – can you rephrase that?
I will rephrase this. I think what he means is rather than pitching, say, Naruto to the studio – instead, you find one little one-shot volume of manga, maybe doesn't have the huge fan base. Do you think – he's asking, do you think that would work better, have a better chance of selling if you just, you know, picked a short project that wasn't necessarily this massive, monolithic international success?
I think that's a very good question, and it reminds me that I think I read somewhere that Stanley Kubrick used to really not look for novels as much as novellas, short novels, because they would allow – perhaps, I'm just guessing, they would allow him to develop his themes more without crowding him with so much plot to try to jam it in that – amount of running time that's just required for a theatrical feature. At one point, the audience just has to go home. And so I think that's a very interesting idea. And certainly where I'm working, developing manga with students, OEL manga, that's the idea. And because we don't have the system here in America with the whole, it's kind of a craftswoman system over there where they have a team of assistants that work with them usually. And therefore they can turn out more page count. Over here, the OEL mangakas are really limited to themselves. And so their page count is just going to be lower. But that doesn't mean that their stories won't make fantastic movies or television shows. And I think of Hollywood will really, the next wave will start turning towards this. The problem here we have in America is that we don't really have the really deep infrastructure that they have in Japan. For instance, the contests and the real long-term editor mangaka relationship building that they have over there. And so we've got to find other ways to develop that. And I think eventually it may, and it already is happening in a certain key place, the university setting and particularly art departments that are merging with great storytelling expertise will develop that. And the key for the mangakas here is going to be to make sure that they're not becoming clones and like the poor man, poor woman's version of Japanese work, like knockoffs, but instead develop their own style that works and that really works on a level of great storytelling, character empathy, world building, but that uses the visual stylistics that in a broad way that makes the mangas work so well as the storytelling techniques, but I think will tend more towards a more Western style of plot structure. And that combined could really, really make some things happen.
Right. And we got a couple of short questions about your involvement in OEL, in OEL manga, and you apparently teach script writing for that particular field.
Yeah, what we're doing is that a question or?
I'm sort of melding a couple of questions into one and just introducing it as a topic.
Yeah. So what I'm doing is, of course, my background is as a storyteller, right? I'm not an artist, but can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
I found that that if you put the students in a situation and develop a lot of different techniques for them to cross critique each other, if they have strong art backgrounds and you teach them the keys to sequential art, using mangaka's existing, both OEL experience mangaka's materials that they've given me actually to use because they're my friends, or in the case of certain material that has been made available to me through Viz, that then can be enough to really make amazing things happen. And we're using the internet as well as this thing called Blackboard. And they're required to go up on the internet and give each other X number of critiques per class. And we've got the Wacom Intuos 4 tablets for them, which is just working amazing. And we're having them work innovatively in terms of development of their technique. You know, some are, you know, strictly old school in the way their production techniques, others are doing amazing things on the computer, and others are doing other things. And they're doing such incredible innovation in the way that they're actually producing the manga that then they're creating PowerPoints and video AVI files just on instructing each other what they're learning. It's amazing.
Wow.
So I'm going to launch these at several of the series at Anime Expo on the OEL panel.
Okay.
On July 3rd, which will be in tandem with right before is the Manga Meets Hollywood panel. And we have different guests on each panel. So it's very, very exciting.
Well,
these kids are amazing.
We'll make sure we cover that in our Anime Expo coverage. Now that I know, I'll make sure I put it on schedule and have some reporters there.
Fantastic. And you'll be knocked out, I think. You really will.
So that begs the question, and this is sort of an unpleasant question, but I have to ask. There haven't really been any majorly successful OEL manga in the U.S. The one everyone points to is Svetlana, whatever her last name is, Dramacon. They all point to that one. But most of them seem like they've kind of fizzled or just didn't generate much interest. Fans seem to kind of reject it based on the fact that it was drawn by an American. You know, they're elitist about that kind of thing. Are you hopeful that this stuff is really going to take off, given like Tokyo Pop's history with it, you know, that kind of thing? What do you think?
Well, I think anything is an uphill battle, particularly when you're coming out of nowhere with this. But I think that there's always the future. You know, it's like what London was in the 60s and then what New York was in the 70s and then what. And I think every place has its time to be the place where things are happening. And in terms of OEL previously, I think the reason we put the panels on at Anime Expo was in beginning last year was to try to address this very valid question that you're asking, which is like what's gone wrong and what's gone right and how to fix the wrongs. Part of it is the lack of tankobon because we don't have – there's not kind of the way to bring an artist along. It's just kind of like you're thrown in the deep end and told, go make a graphic novel. Here's $2,000. Come back in a year. You know, and that's no way to – do it. I think, you know, there needs to be an infrastructure there where someone is with them in partnership and helping them go along and giving them feedback, including their peers, but also somebody taking some kind of an editorial role with them. That's more. And the problem is we don't have the financial income in the manga industry here, in terms of, because we don't have hits that supports that kind of infrastructure. And so I think that they were trying to go straight to graphic novel without the tankobon. And understandably, the tankobons didn't survive financially, although Shonen Jump is still going. But so it's like, where to go, you know? And I think that the university system provides a natural structure that could, with the right tweaks, be used to kind of replace a lot of what's missing there. But obviously, once there's a breakout hit, then the publishers will hopefully take more risks. But also, there may be an evolution where this stuff gets platformed off into TV, into movies, and also direct into animation. I'm thinking one connection to do might be to connect OEL to Korean animation, for instance, and find a way to finance excellent OEL projects through Korean production. With co-financiers. But it's a big open question, and I think part of it has to do with whether there's going to be a lot of adaptation in the digital form, you know, with the iPad, which we all know about, and everything else. I'd love to have a conversation with y'all about this, actually, rather than me doing all the talking, because I'm sure you could shed some amazing light on it.
I mean, my only comment is that I have yet to see one that's a true breakout. I read Tokyopop for years would send big bags of books, you know, from their OEL projects, the rising stars of manga, and the ones that they were heavily promoting were, to put bluntly, terrible. Like the one that they really pushed was Bizengast, and Bizengast was the incredibly uninspired. Obviously, like, let's just throw Jim Henson's Labyrinth in with Tim Burton visuals and give it a storyline that can go forever, a la, you know, a Cardcaptor Sakura or something. I mean, it's just a collection of uninspired influences. And I saw that over and over again with their OEL titles. I mean, these were bright kids, and they had potential, but we're getting, you know, basically these ideas were in the fetal stage, I think, when they decided to launch the book. These artists were not ready. And some of the art was flat out amateurish, like just really bad stuff. And so I think I'm just kind of waiting around, you know, when are we going to see, you know, the true breakout super talented artist, you know, paired with a super talented writer that can produce something that's up to par with even like a B-list anime title.
Well, I think, I'm sorry, are you done?
I'm done. My rant is over.
Okay, sure. Well, I think that one emphasis that I put on here that I've really put to the foreground here was story, 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 and character, character, character. And when you talk about underdeveloped stories, I have one of my star students who's got a wonderful series called Project Alpha. What he did was he first wrote it as three consecutive screenplays, a trilogy of this science fiction world that he built. And then he took that world, synthesized it down, and refined it through rewriting the beginning of the screenplay. And then he switched it over to a manga. So this thing is so in depth that he can tell you what happens 52 panels from now in the most incredible detail, where he just knows his story inside and out, and he's really developing. He's constantly refining it and looking for ways to improve it. And I think that that's really, really critical. And then the art, as you said, has to be wonderful as well. It's really an issue of developing a very original vision, but that's very attractive to people, that knocks people out with a wonderful story that's super developed and very, very much empathy with the characters, and not appearing to mimic Japanese manga, really getting your own thing going, but that your own thing going is great. And as we know, you know, it's one of those things like you'll know it when you see it, right?
Yep, exactly. Okay.
And I'm seeing it, by the way, and you're going to be seeing it too if you come to this.
Yeah, so. Okay, well, we're actually about out of time here. The other question we have, the other question we have for you, you kind of already answered. So I guess we'll wrap up just by letting people know that they can see you at Anime Expo. Do you know what time your panels are?
Our panels are, I'll have to check real quick, but I know they're in the afternoon. I believe they're between 1 and 3, and one is going to be just wonderful people on it. We're going to have, and I'm probably going to miss some names, but Robert Napton from Bondi, who's a wonderful graphic novel writer, successful as well. He's going to be on the original English language panel. And we have a bunch of other great guests on that. And then our Manga to Hollywood, and including a mangaka. On the Hollywood Manga Comes to Hollywood panel, we have great guests too, like Joshua Long, who was instrumental in the Cowboy Bebop deal.
Yeah, we know.
Nobuo Masuda, who's instrumental, who's Sunrise USA and was involved in that deal as well as other ones. And so both panels are going to be absolutely fantastic. And we've got, a former editor from Tokyo Pop on the OEL panel, and it's a great group of people. And so I think people will really get a kick out of both those panels. And I'm going to show the work on the OEL panel so people can see one example of new OEL that's coming out of young inspired students and see what they think. And so I hope to see you all there.
Great. Yeah. And hey, after 2 hours after that, if you swing by Live Programming too, you can see the live and cast that Justin and I will be recording there at the show. So
I would love that. Is that at 4?
It's at 5.
Oh, that's at 5? Okay, fantastic. I would absolutely love that. And yeah, that's perfect. That's perfect. Pack it in. We look forward to seeing you all there. We're trying to advance OEL and figure out ways to make it work better. And we're trying to make – and I was going to say, regarding the Japanese rights holders, they have a right to be protective of their work, and they have created wonderful work. So we want to make productions that reflect the best of what they've done and protect it. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And all right. Thanks a lot, man. Okay, that's our show. I want to thank Northrop for joining us. Don't forget, this podcast was brought to you by Endors Interactive's Atlantica Online at playatlantica.com. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes, and we'll see you all next week. Oh, shit. Sorry, guys. I almost forgot. Heat Guy J.